Knowledge at Wharton here on Sirius XM 132 Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School. Thanks for spending part of your day with us. We are with you live for 2 hours each and every weekday, 10 a.m. Eastern Time, 7 a.m. Pacific, and then our show replays later in the day in the evenings, 10 p.m. East, 7 p.m. Pacific Time. Also, a reminder, make sure that you go to the Sirius XM website and download the app so that you can listen to all the great channels here on the Sirius XM network. Download the app to your smartphone, your tablet, your home computer, whatever you like. SiriusXM.com/app to find out more. When Party City announced it was closing 45 stores this year, some pointed to the global shortage of helium as a possible cause. A spokesperson for the event's retailer later denied that. Still, the shortage of the chemical element is impacting more than just the entertainment business. The gas is used in weather research, magnets in MRI machines for deep sea diving, among other things. It's also used by numerous researchers at both the collegiate and professional level. But what you may not realize is that helium is mostly a byproduct collected while producing natural gas or liquefied natural gas. So why is there a shortage and how serious is it? Phil Kornbluth is the founder and president of Kornbluth Helium Consultancy. Sophia Hayes is a chemistry professor at Washington University in St. Louis, and they join us now. Phil, Sophia, thank you for your time today.
Thanks, Dan. My pleasure.
Thanks for having us on.
Thank you.
It's an important issue.
Thank you. So, Sophia, give us some background here as to how this helium shortage actually came about.
So that's a little bit more of a difficult question because it involves the supply chain for helium and geopolitical situations with Qatar and other suppliers, as well as what's going on with our current pipeline and reserve of helium in the United States. So I think you could sum it up quickly by saying, given that there are so few sources worldwide, anytime the supply takes a hit, when there's a single plant that's not in operation or when there's a problem in Qatar, then I think that affects everybody, not just in the United States.
Phil, your thoughts?
Well, I would say, it's a story about depletion and decline of some of the long existing sources of helium, with replacement sources not coming into the market quickly enough to fill the gap from the declines of the existing sources. So, one point that I think the media often gets wrong, you'll read headlines about the runaway growth in helium demand and things like that. This shortage, as well as the previous shortage, were supply driven, or failure of supply.
And as you kind of alluded to there, this is not a new occurrence. This is something that has happened relatively often over the last several decades, Phil.
There have been three sustained periods of shortage since 2006. So, we've been, if you add up the numbers, I just did recently, in the last 14 years, we've had seven years of shortage. So we've been 50% shortage in the last 14 years, which is pretty bad.
Sophia, for you at Washington University, how is this impacting you and your work specifically?
So in my work, I do a combination of research that uses liquid helium to sustain some instruments. You referred to MRI magnets.
Yes.
I use a similar kind of magnet to fingerprint chemicals. But in addition to that, I sometimes do low temperature research, so bringing sample temperatures down. And so we experience this as an inability to get helium. And Phil is very knowledgeable in this area. He refers to these three shortages on the supply side. And we, at the end of the spigot, so to speak, or the pipeline, are experiencing these with increasing frequency. When we call a vendor, they simply say that either we have a cutback in supply, we can't get our full order, or they have to delay shipments.
So, Phil, and as we kind of alluded to at the top, many people would assume that in the entertainment business, in the party rental business, you're going to see an impact. But the connection and the linkage to all these other areas, the MRI magnets, deep sea diving, weather research, these are areas I think that are not necessarily by the general public linked to the use of helium.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, helium is a pretty widely used industrial commodity. It has some very interesting usages, like in semiconductor manufacturing or optical fiber manufacturing and in the aerospace industry. So, you know, many folks are really surprised when they hear that helium isn't just about party balloons and the Goodyear blimp. So, you know, there's a lot of industries that are impacted when the price of helium goes up or when the availability goes down.
But I think, and I was thinking about this question myself yesterday, is the fact that it feels like right now we are seeing more of a push to see liquefied natural gas being brought up and being used. So I think that some people would say, well, if we have this push for liquefied natural gas, why are we still having a problem of helium if one is a byproduct of the other?
Well, I mean, the simple answer to that is that not all natural gas has commercial quantities of helium in it. So, you know, when you have helium in the gas and enough gas, then you could have, basically the helium is a waste product from LNG production as it is from some forms of natural gas processing. So helium and nitrogen are typically components of natural gas. They don't burn, and when you purify the methane from natural gas, you throw away all the stuff that doesn't burn, and if there's enough helium in it, then you might have a feed gas for a helium plant. So that's what happens at the plants in Qatar. That's what happens at the plants in Algeria. And there's a plant in Australia, in Darwin, Australia, that also is an LNG plant that where you get helium from the waste. In the long run, I would say as there's more and more LNG plants, you're more likely to have some new helium sources, but that also points to a big part of the problem. A big part of the problem with helium supply is because it's a byproduct, before the industrial gas companies can build a new helium plant, they might need somebody else to make a multi-billion dollar investment in an LNG plant.
Right.
And the folks aren't doing that to get helium. They're doing it to get LNG. So the helium suppliers don't have as much control as they would like over the development of new sources.
And I'm guessing that the profitability is much higher on the LNG side than it would be on the helium side?
Well, it's just much bigger. You know, it's right. A much, much larger business.
What about this? So for the helium that is out there, what about the storage of that as a product, especially considering, Phil, that as you categorized it, it's a waste product?
Well, I mean, as far as like storage in large quantities, it's really not very practical. So the only really, really large scale storage in the world right now is in the Federal Reserve, in Cliffside. It's called the Cliffside Dome or Bush Dome, Cliffside Field or Bush Dome Reservoir. And it's stored as crude helium, which is an impure form of helium.
Right.
So, that's a problem. I mean, you can't store a really large quantity in purified form.
Actually, I'd like to build on that point, if
sure.
you don't mind. And Phil, your perspective is excellent on this, because I think that that's really honing in on the issue. It's a bit on the supply side and this separation from LNG, but also, as my friend and colleague Bill Halperin makes this point, it really is about this distribution point and the storage point. Because helium is a special material, because it's so non-reactive, it's extraordinarily difficult to store and to transport.
Right.
So the tanks that we normally think of to store gases are, leak helium out at slow rates. But nevertheless, it's hard to have long-term storage. So it's a product that's an almost on-demand kind of thing where it's hard to maintain inventory. In addition, I just learned from speaking to some folks in Qatar that they are having trouble just getting the sources at specific ports where helium can be dispensed, if you will, from their domestic production. So there's these issues of transport and storage that I think drive a lot of this. And this is new perspective that I've come to, again, through Bill Halperin's point of view as well as yours.
So, Sophia, you both have mentioned Qatar, and I guess to give the listeners some perspective, Qatar seems like it is truly one of the cornerstones of this industry, and I'm guessing from a little bit of a historic perspective that they've been, in a similar manner for quite some time.
Well, they've been blockaded in terms of their trade and shipments for some time now, and so when they're one of the three major worldwide suppliers And, you know, you can imagine Asia is getting their supplies in part from Qatar. So when there's a breakdown in that part of the supply chain, of course, the U.S. supplies may be routed in different directions. And Phil would probably know more about that than I.
Phil?
Well, you know, the Qatar is an important source. It's about 30% of the world supply. And, you know, what I was, thinking recently as we started seeing some threats to oil shipments through the Straits of Hormuz, I'm thinking about, well, geez, oil is more important to the world than helium. But if the Straits of Hormuz were to get closed, 30% of the world's helium would be stuck immediately, because there is a land blockade that's been in place since June of 2017. If you couldn't take it out by cargo ship, you wouldn't be able to take it out, period. So that is a, again, it's not as big a threat as the threat of disrupting oil shipments, but it would be a widely felt impact on industry.
So what kind of pricing impact, Phil, are we seeing because of this shortage?
We've seen a big pricing impact. Mostly due to the shortage, but also due to the fact that the U.S. Bureau of Land Management, when they conducted their last auction and sale of helium last August 31st and September 4th, and the prices that the crude helium sold for were pretty dramatically higher than they had been in previous years. And since many of the industry's contracts are indexed, the prices are indexed to the BLM's crude helium prices, that caused a fairly significant cost impact to the major helium suppliers. But having said that, in a shortage period, those major suppliers were not going to absorb that cost increase. They were going to pass it through plus to their customer base. So we've had a pretty dramatic series of price increases, and many helium users have had their price increased by 50%, and some have even been increased by 100%.
Sophia, I would imagine that is part of the problem that you are dealing with and your institution is dealing with, the cost side of it, in terms of trying to do the research that you would like to do on an annual basis.
Absolutely. Of course, we're on fixed budgets from federal agencies, and so when one of our important commodity chemicals doubles in price, so that's going to have a large impact.
844-WHARTON is the number to give us a call, 844-942-7866. Or if you'd like, send us a comment on Twitter at BizRadio132 or my Twitter account, which is at DanLoney21. Phil Kornbluth of Kornbluth Helium Consultancy joining us on the phone, along with Sophia Hayes of Washington University in St. Louis. Sophia, give us, if you can, for a second, the connection between helium and the magnets that are used in your work, but also in MRIs as well.
So those are what are called superconducting magnets. They're made of special materials that change their state, if you will, of matter as they get cooled by liquid helium. It allows them to conduct electricity without losing any of that energy to heat, and that creates extremely strong magnetic fields. So it's important to keep these materials, these special materials, bathed in liquid helium at all times. If you get low or run out of helium, that superconducting state will be lost, and this very expensive piece of capital equipment can become irreparably damaged.
And so I would imagine that some of this equipment, whether it be there at your facility in St. Louis or in others and potentially in hospitals around the country with MRI machines, that they are having to take a different approach to the using of these pieces of equipment.
No, you're absolutely correct. What people have done in the MRI field is they've installed devices to recirculate the helium in a closed cycle kind of system. And I've used the analogy before that it's like the radiator of your car, where the cooling fluid circulates around and around. So while that's true in the MRI market and is becoming very common practice, in the research end of things, we don't have at all times the ability to adopt such recycling.
Phil?
Well, you know, one of the ways that certain users have coped with this helium shortage and the previous helium shortages and price increases, et cetera, you know, is that they have looked for substitutes for helium. In some cases, they've been successful, and there's been a, you know, increasingly efficient use. So the MRI example is a really, really good one, as the, you know, the current MRI magnets are much more efficient in their helium consumption, and it's just more recycling. So, you know, demand destruction is part of the part of what's going on. I mean, in the last helium shortage, I would say that maybe 10% of global demand was lost due to recycling and substitution. And while it may not be as big this time around, because let's say the easy pickings have been already harvested, I would still think that that there will be demand destruction during this shortage period, and that's part of how the market works to deal with a shortage. You know, either you develop new supply or you reduce demand, but right, there'll be a new equilibrium.
Well, playing off of that point specifically, with the fact that Qatar is almost a third of the market, where potentially could be those new sources coming from, Phil?
Well, there's a third plant in Qatar that is hopefully going to enter the market in 2020. There's a very large new project in Russia called the Amur Project that is planned to hit the market in 2021. There are several other projects in the works. And then there's a whole host of companies who are exploring for helium in the southwestern United States and in Saskatchewan and Alberta, Canada, and even in Tanzania. And what's unique about these sources is helium is the primary commercial target as opposed to hydrocarbons. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so far these non-hydrocarbon sources only account for a few percent of global supply. But it'll be interesting to see if some of these companies are successful in developing new supply.
Sophia, if you are looking at this problem from your perspective, what are the potential solutions that you think need to be considered at this point?
I think Phil said it elegantly. We need to do more recycling so we reduce demand. And because there's a finite supply of helium on the Earth, it would be terrific to see more efforts to integrate such recycling beyond MRI machines.
844-942-7866. Or if you'd like, send us a comment on Twitter at BizRadio132 or my Twitter account, which is at DanLoney21. So how much, Phil, is actually recycled at this point?
You know, that's a good question. I don't have data for that, but I can tell you, for example, where the MRI magnets are manufactured, let's say by companies like GE or Philips or Siemens, literally hundreds of millions of feet per year are recycled. Those used to be some of the world's largest consumers of helium, and all of those really large consuming locations have put in recycling. So, you know, a large quantity that at one time you would say was wasted in a way because it was used once when it could have been recycled, a pretty large quantity from the largest application is now recycled. And MRI machines that used to require top-offs with liquid helium more than once a month, now, some of those machines now require top-offs once a year or less. So there have been tremendous strides increasing the efficiency of helium use.
But it also sounds like that you also expect with some of these other plants that are coming online and maybe even more, I would think, down the road, that the investment side of this in actually putting in the infrastructure and investing in this type of process is going to be something that will continue on down the pike, Phil.
I do. I mean, one of the things, when I look at the future, I think that the 2020s, at least after the Russian source starts up, will be a better decade for helium availability than the 2010s. But the supply chain, and I think Sophia mentioned this earlier, is relatively fragile. It's become a mostly just-in-time supply chain, and what the industry has lost and what it enjoyed for many years was a great deal of flexibility that it derived from the Federal Reserve and the what's called the BLM, Bureau of Land Management, crude helium pipeline. That flex capacity is no longer available.
Sophia?
No, exactly. I think that's what's coming for us, is an era where there may be more supply available, but in order to absorb these kinds of shocks, finding helium alternatives, like Phil referred to, as well as recycling, are going to be the way to go.
But you're also talking about, Sophia, a significant, if we are making adjustments to this, as we move forward, you're talking about also having to make adjustments within the infrastructure as well of a lot of companies that would be using helium in the first place.
Agreed. And so thinking about that market of MRI machines being, let's say, 20% of U.S. consumption, the other 80% may not be doing this kind of recycling. And so there's a lot of potential there.
Great having you both with us. Thank you, Phil. Thank you, Sophia. All the best.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you. Phil Kornbluth, who is founder and president of Kornbluth Helium Consultancy, Sophia Hayes, chemistry professor at Washington University in St. Louis. We will take a break. Second hour of Knowledge at Wharton coming up in just a minute after the break. Our number of the day, you may have heard this story, but it is one that bears repeating. Just an incredible story from over the weekend about how a billionaire is giving back to an institution of higher learning, more specifically to the students who just graduated from that school. And then we're going to be talking about sin taxes. We have talked about them, specifically taxes added to things like cigarettes, and here in Philadelphia over the last couple of years, soda. What is the research in terms of how those sin taxes are actually working? Are they doing the job that is intended of them to do? We'll talk about that coming up in just a couple of seconds. And then in our final 30, we will chat with Dean Foster, author of the book, The Global Etiquette Guide, to talk about how companies are supposed to be able to set their structures in place, especially when they are in other countries. We'll talk about that coming up at 11:30 Eastern Time. Second hour of Knowledge at Wharton in just a minute here on Sirius XM 132 Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School.
Another one.